Med nami pa je tudi profesor dr. Günther Firth, ki je vernik in ki je etik in zato smo veseli, da nam bo on lahko predstavil svojo praktično izkušnjo v zvezi z tem vprašanjem, z praktično izkušnjo, ki jo ima pri svojem delu v Bruslju.
I thank you so much for this invitation to this excellent and great symposium and to this presentation also. As you may have heard, I was born in 1940. We are a few months difference between my friend Professor Trondel and me. And it was after the war. My father was missed in the war. Great poverty. And the best what my mother could do for me was a good education in a Catholic school with the Benedictine monks. So I'm so grateful for this chance and possibility. It's a pity that in this time we had only three classes, English in the high school, and so I've before the great problem, I do not speak English very well. I sent my German paper to Roman. Congratulations to this excellent symposium here, organizing. And now I have my German text and I have to translate it in English on my own. So please be patient with me when I try to do this. My English is far from good and far from perfect. And you will find the Slovenian translation then in the book. Or here. Oh, okay. Fine. No problem. The significance of ethical counseling for European lawmakers is my theme after this excellence lecture, a keynote lecture from Professor Trondel. So I come from some personal experience and my self-understanding in the role of ethical counseling in a secularized Europe. We are presently witnessing a strong increase of ethical committees and ethics counseling of various kinds. Thousands of ethics committees, I have in memory more than 5,000 in Europe, by law are compulsory to advise researchers in questions of medical research involving human patients, medical trials. In many hospitals, ethical committees give advice for treatment for patients, and ethical committees have also been founded as advisory panels for politicians in many states in Europe at national level. And in European level, the Council of Europe, now 47 member states, Strasbourg, and also the European Union, Brussels, 27 member states now, has standing ethical committees. Why does this increase happen and where does it lead to? How we can interpret this increasing of ethical committees, of thousand and thousand ethical committees? Ethics was first established as an independent part of philosophy by Aristotle in his three large ethical books in a time when the first democracy of this world in his hometown and state of Athens was very close to its destruction by corruption and populistic politics. Ethics is not morality, but rather the theory of morality. Ethics is a topic that is increasingly discussed in a situation where in a crisis, a society can no longer deal adequately with the decision problems of individuals and of society as a whole. Ethics is a normative, philosophical or theological doctrine of human action and attitudes insofar as these can be classified as human right and human wrong, as good and evil. In the course of history, ethics was subsequently institutionalized at universities, and in the second half of the 20th century, in addition, interdisciplinary ethical committees were founded. One of the reasons why ethical committees were deemed necessary were the experience of the atrocities with human experimentation committed in Nazi Germany, but also in the US and also in Japan. Further, phenomena of crisis of morals are not only the corruption, but also the new problems of decision. The new science gives us opportunities our parents had not decided. We have to decide. And our morality from yesterday is not enough for this solution of these decision problems. And another problem is the pluralism of morality. Which morality? When you go to the supermarket of moralities in our modern society. Under morals in this context, I understand the summary of rules of which we base our decisions and actions in our daily life without reflection, so to say, as a routine. The following deliberations are based on the interpretation that the increasing number of ethical committees is a sign of a great moral crisis in our society. So I will first report my experiences in different ethical committees in more than 30 years, and second, give a reflection on my method on ethical arguing and my role as a theological ethicist or moral theologian. First, my first experiences in ethical committees was the membership in the research ethical committee of the Medical University. This invitation, when I come to Vienna, back home in my university, was really unexpected. And what I had to do, first to study all the regulations, hard law, national and international, and soft law, also Helsinki Declaration and all these documents. To be able, not an expert in medicine, to put the right questions in the right moment. I think that's the role, that was my first role, my self-understanding, to be very alert, to hear where are the problems, and to put the right questions in the right moment. And then the discussion begins. So many people of good will try then to find a better solution. In this research ethical committees, it's a procedure of controlling if the norms are met, the norms of international and national and also soft law are met. It's a procedure of norm controlling, not or very seldom to have real ethical decisions. This ethics is enshrined in these documents. Really different are the targets of the national ethics committees in Austria, the ethics committee to the chancellor, to advise politicians in preparation of laws. The great problem of these national ethics committees, I speak from my country now, maybe it's in other countries other, is the appointment through the politician, through the chancellor, who always comes from one political party. And so the balance of such a national ethics committee and the independence of the members is challenged. And such an ethical committee can become an instrument for party policy. For the moral theologian or theological ethicists, It is very important to see through the hidden secular dogma. Not only the church has dogma, also the secular society has their dogmas, and Professor Trondel mentioned a lot. For instance, liberal slope, to get more and more liberal. So the hidden dogma, the most liberal solution in Europe should be valid also for our country. This is a hidden dogma in our ethical committees. Or another dogma, you have to argue without metaphysics, whatever it means. That means without background, to hide their own background. And also juridical positivism has its secular dogmas. So you have, as a theological ethicist, to be alert to look through these hidden modern secular dogmas. To my surprise, in 1998, I got a visit from the former vice president of the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, an Austrian deputy, and she found in the Council of Europe, now 47 member states in Strasbourg, found a motion, a preparation of a new document for the termination of life on request, to justify to hasten death, was the first sentence of this document. It was not signed, but it was ready for a motion. And she, the vice president, she lives now in Villach, not far away from here, came to me at the university. She has read a book of mine, Life to the End. It's translated in Czech language and not in Slovenian. It's a pity. And asked me to help her to make an own document. She said, not in this way, I will make the document on a political way, and she invited me to help her. So I got an official letter of the General Secretary of the Council of Europe. I shall make a draft about the fulfillment of the wishes of the terminally ill and dying person. It was clear for me that in this title was a presupposition. We wish termination of life, and you have to do it. This was the intention. With this title, I got the letter. As you can imagine, I changed the title. I changed the title to the protection of human rights and dignity of the terminally ill and dying. And we made in our institute, with a team of different physicians, lawyers, and so on, a draft. It's only 3 pages. Explanatory memorandum is more than. And what we did, first to analyze the problems and the anxieties of people in our modern society before dying. And we gave the advice for the politicians in 47 European countries, Council of Europe, by recognizing and protecting a terminally ill or dying person's right to comprehensive palliative care while taking the necessary measures. So the first point was palliative medicine, palliative care, with 10 different recommendations. It's boring to you too. You can read it in my abstract. You will find the internet links. You can read it then and get it. 3 pages. It's not too much. It's just for the politicians. The second point was protection of the terminally ill or dying person's right to self-determination while taking the necessary measures, again, 7 measures. That means strengthening of autonomy and self-determination of the ill person, also the terminally ill and dying person. In the sense that nobody could be coerced to medical treatment which may be futile in the last phase, and you can refuse it, self-determination in this way. And also we ask that advanced directives should get a juridical form in the member states. So some states did it, others will maybe do it. And the third point was to uphold the prohibition against intentionally taking the life of terminally ill or dying persons. In accordance with Article 2 of the European Convention of Human Rights, which states, no one shall be deprived of his life intentionally in Europe. And that a terminally ill or dying person's wish to die never constitutes any legal claim to die at the hand of another person. So clear against that what we call euthanasia. But we avoided in the whole document to mention the word euthanasia, because it's such misunderstandings in the different societies, in the different histories, and it's such an emotional background. So we describe the problems without using the word euthanasia in this document. When we presented this draft in the committee of the parliament, 5 hours, we found a broad atmosphere of liberalization. Terminating life on request, yet should be allowed. And the main argumentations, and then you have to argue in a convincing way for the politicians, were 2 points. First, when letting die is admissible, why not to kill? And so the first point was to give clear criteria about this difference that physicians everybody know on 3 levels. The level of causality, the level of intention, and the level of background motivation, and all together. And the second point was, why autonomy is valid, I can refuse medical treatment, why I cannot ask terminating of life. Why not? Autonomy is autonomy. This was the great question, 5 hours. And I hope, and we were able in a long discussion to make clear that autonomy turns to the opposite when you overstretch autonomy. Then these ill people in a weak situation get under pressure, as also the physicians in such a society. In 1999, our recommendation was accepted with great majority in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. The Ministers' Committee welcomed several times this recommendation, and the European Human Rights Court based some decisions on this document. And the Council of Europe in Strasbourg works since 1999 every year with a symposium on the basis of this recommendation. In 2012, they had a symposium, a great symposium, about end-of-life decisions. Now I invite you to come with an aeroplane from Strasbourg with me to Brussels, in the European Union in Brussels. Since 1993, there is an ethical committee, a central ethical committee, for the advice of the President of the European Union and the Commission. This ethical committee was established first to advise the President in the beginning biotechnologies in 1993. When I was appointed in 2001 from President Romano Prodi this time, for 4 years, this group had the name European Group on Ethics in Science and Technologies. It's another remit than in Strasbourg, really under remit. European Group on Ethics in Science and Technologies. Why? The European Union, in the European Union, in Lisbon Treaty now, specific ethical problems like euthanasia, Strasbourg, or abortion, or PGD, and all these things are under subsidiarity. They have regulation in the member states and not in the European Union. It's under subsidiarity. And you have to battle for this subsidiarity. I can tell you several times I have to say, stop, that's subsidiarity. This group is now broadened to 15 members, 5 ethicists, 5 lawyers, and 5 scientists. And the remit is not only the biotechnology, but also all new technologies. So the EGE, the European Group on Ethics in Science and Technologies, EGE, I use this abbreviation, EGE made opinions about nanomedicine, new technologies in agriculture against hunger in the world, synthetic biology, information and communication technology, the energy mix for the energy security for Europe until 2050. We finished last a few weeks ago. And now we work on Opinion 28 about surveillance technologies and security, a great problem also for the future. The EGE, members of the EGE, are independent. So I, as a moral theologian, I am not a representative of my country and I'm not representative of my church. I'm bound only to my own conscience. We are independent, we are multidisciplinary, that's important also, and pluralistic with our background. The nomination comes from the president personally, who elected under 100, more than 150 applications came in the European Union, and he elected 15 persons for several 5 years. President Barroso expects that we make an opinion in consensus, also knowing that we are very, very pluralistic background. And at his last visit, he told us, yes, I have to work in this room. So we work in the same room where the commission works. So it's a really high-level group. I have to find consensus with 27 commissioners, the government of Europe. I have to do this. I expect from you, from the ethicists also, to bring a document in consensus. So in what to do when you are not in consensus. In 2001, when I was vocated in the opinion about patentability of human stem cells, I got problems in my own conscience. The group, the EGE, was not ready to distinguish between patenting of embryo, human embryo, and adult stem cells. And one of the members withdrew the membership. And it was very difficult for me what to do in this delicate situation. I decided to stay. And I made the first time in the group, and it was the really one time in the group, a dissent opinion. We are asked to make an opinion in consensus. This time I made a dissent opinion. Before I put my signature under the document. I formulated my dissent opinion through my interpretation of the Biopatent Directive of the European Union. So you have to know the documents. Very good. In Article 6 of this Biopatent Directive, it's clearly written that for moral reasons, to exclude from patent is the use of human embryos for industrial and commercial uses. For industrial and commercial uses only. But in number 5 of the same document, it's written that a patent of a gene presupposes the commercial use. Without commercial use, you cannot get a patent in Europe other than in the US. From these both articles together, I concluded the sense of the Biopatent Directive that we shall in Europe not give patents on the basis of destruction and use of human embryos. So at the end, I was 1-11 in the EGE. Again, along my conviction, the intentionally destroying of an human embryo, beginning human life, for stem cells also, is ethical not reasonably, and the use of human life also at the very beginning for raw material. The most interest is toxicity testing from the pareutical companies. That's the main use. And it's against human dignity. And human dignity, you cannot graduate. You cannot say in the first weeks you have 1% human dignity, then to get more, and at the end of life you decrease, at the end you have some few percent of human dignity. It's an impossible thought. Human dignity, as Professor Trondel said, it's not graduating when every human being, as the Council of Europe, better says to the European Union, the wording is better in the Council of Europe than in the European Union, every human being has human dignity. So in the press conference, my dissent opinion was reported very fair and also accepted from the group. The European Patent Office studied my dissent opinion, and after several procedures, they followed my dissent opinion, the arguments. So ethics is not a question of majority, but a question of arguments. Maybe one argument is decisive, and maybe there are other arguments, utilitarian arguments beside them. So the European Patent Office followed my dissent opinion, and Professor Brüstle last year tried again to gain a patent on the basis of embryonic stem cells, and this question was brought to the European Court in Luxembourg. And the European Court in Luxembourg, in last instance in 2012, decided in Europe, no patents on moral reasons on the basis of destruction of human embryos. So after 11 years, my dissent opinion, when I was first alone against all, is now the last decision in the European Court. Now, we are not at the end. Now the problem starts. A problem in ethics always starts again when you have solved one problem. the problem before we are now is the coherence of European law systems. A human embryo within the patent law is not another than out of patent law. But many people argue in this way. So it's the next step we have to think over. In most of the opinions of the EGE, We succeeded to integrate our convictions in a balanced document, and the role of the theological ethicist is not to always to be against, but to work proactive, to engage and to commit, and also to know the group dynamics of such a group. It's very, very important. So you see in the questions of ethics, not majority is decisive, but the quality of the arguments. And this is now the problem, and I come to an end, which with ethical reasoning, you can stay in such a pluralistic and secular ethics committee. How a Christian faith and ethical reason come together? What is the self-understanding of a moral theologian or theological ethicist, and which role he takes in such a committee? Both questions are linked together. You have also to find a model of ethical argumentation in which you give reasons which are connectable also to the reasons of the others and for communication. Without making a restriction of Christian faith. How Christian faith and reason belong together. Are there specific Christian norms which can be deduced only from Christian dogmas? Is there a Christian peculiar spatial moral which is not valid for all human beings? These are the questions. In the ethical committees for political advice, we set the course for the future regulations in Europe. In which society we want that the next generations can live. And I see so many young people in which society you should live. We set the course now. In the last opinion about the energy future of Europe, we recommended the Commission in Brussels to establish an ombuds institution for future generations, which must heard in all regulations for the future. Ethical committee is only a small part of political advice. The greatest part of a political advice comes from the lobbyist. In Brussels, we estimate we have about 20,000 high-paid lobbyists of the great companies. And I put it a question last week in Brussels, who advised the commissions about surveillance technologies? And after questioning and questioning again, I got the answer, 95% are lobbyists. They want to sell these new technologies. This the horizon in which we do our ethical work. The power of definition, what's life, is now dominated by the compound from economy, science, and technique. When you read biosciences, in our modern society, there is understand medicine, biology, and in the future, converging technologies, brain research, and so on. In former times, philosophy and theology were the life sciences. So it's the tension in which we stay and work, and to bring this together. In this context, the theological ethicists is challenged to reflect on the theology of the earthly realities. I do not know if this is autonomous. You have it better here. Okay, fine. The Second Vatican Council on 7 points speaks about the autonomy of earthly realities. Is this valid also for Essex? It's an open question in the Second Vatican Council. And this is the question before I stay with my model of ethical reasoning. And I will present you, and I come to an end now, my model of ethical reasoning. Every ethical judgment has in the first step to reflect on the different pluralistic prejudices over a special ethical problem and to check these different pluralistic prejudices. How to check? In a first step, a broad empirical foundation. You must be clear what about we talk or what we have to evaluate in ethics. This empirical foundation is in a second step to integrate in an anthropological understanding of succeeding human life in happiness. And then in the third step, you can find a concrete ethical judgment, often through balancing. The problem is, most times when you read the literature, people try direct from the empirical foundation without anthropological integration to come to the balancing. And this is in the classical tradition of ethics, natural fallacy. From east to old, there is no transition. We remember David Hume. No rational ethical process is in a vacuum. Ethical arguing is always embedded in historical and in societal and also in faith horizons. We do not reflect often about these horizons, but they have a great influence. How? When you look at the autonomy of ethical reasoning and the authenticity of faith, then you have the chance to reflect the interaction between reason and faith in a different way. What is this Christian horizon? This Christian horizon of faith, you can best quote the New Testament. The eldest document of the New Testament is the letter of St. Paul to the community in Thessaloniki, in Saloniki. And in the first verse, he says, he appeals the faith, the hope, and the charity. Faith, hope, and charity. This, we call it theologically virtues. Why? Why you cannot gain it by repetition and ascesis. You have to get it in a broader context. So this is the horizon. I have always to be alert of this horizon. And on several pages in the Bible, always you find these three together: faith, hope, and charity. Coming from the faith that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and life. So theology is life sciences, it's life science also. Between this horizon of faith and these steps of ethical reasoning is an intensive interaction. And I try to put 4 points of this interaction: a critical interaction, a stimulating interaction, and integrating interaction, and a motivational interaction. Alfons Auer, after the encyclical Humani Vitae, brought his book Autonomy Moral in a Christian context. And he started a discussion under moral theologians, and he presented his method, how he developed the classical teaching of natural law in a modern epistemological way. And with this method, you can deal with the new problems and can also argue credible in an ethical committee. At the very end, the examples how the critical effect of the phase horizon comes in. And I think I gave you a good example with my dissent opinion, no patenting for embryonic stem cells. It came from the critics of my phase horizon. For the stimulating effect of phase horizon, I can tell you the hospice movement initiated from Christian people for the better a companion of the dying persons, and it was the background for me working for the Council of Europe, protection of the human rights. It's a stimulating effect, not only critic, but a stimulating effect. For the integrating effect, maybe I can give you the hint to the debate about the foundation of ecological ethics. So you have the different anthropocentric approaches, you have the biocentric approaches, the pathocentric approaches, the holistic approaches, and so on. When you integrate this modern discussion of foundation of ecological ethics, and it's very important, in theology of creation, then you can serve these values, but you beware them for to be absolute. That's always the problem in a secular ethical reasoning. You see good values, but there is also always the attempt to make what I see that is absolute. Integration means see it in the broader context. Then a better balancing is possible. When someone asked me, what motivates me since more than 30 years to work in ethical committee, I can only say it's my faith. And the chance for such a commitment are also in a secular Europe not bad. In the Lisbon Treaty, you can read in Article 17, the European Union shall maintain an open, transparent, and regular dialogue with the churches and religious associations and communities. So the door is very wide open, and it depends on the Christians, on the individuals, on the churches, and also on the theological ethicists to go through this open door. Thank you for your long attendance, and maybe I could motivate some young friends in our midst to go to this open door. Thank you.